It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro Recharge Kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Podcast is hashtag Boone approved. It's time for another edition of the Brett Boone Podcast.
Remember when me and you almost went to blows? Lou sent me down three times too, so I know what you're talking about.
With your host, MLB All-Star, Brett Boone.
Bottom line is, you will become a successful major league hitter by hitting pitchers' mistakes.
As he sits down with his sports and entertainment friends from around the world.
You are not going to be a successful major league hitter if you hit pitchers' pitches.
This isn't just any former jocks podcast.
To change the outcome, you got to change the income. You got to change what goes in. Then that changes what goes out.
Often duplicated, but never replicated. Just like his bat flip.
Okay, now the party starts. The responsibility starts now.
Now in its fourth year, this is the one and only Brett Boone Podcast.
Welcome to the Brett Boone Podcast. I'm your host, Brett Boone. And today on the program, I am joined by one of the biggest golf analysts, I'm going to say, in the world today. He's the lead studio host of the Golf Channel, and he's fresh off this year's Masters. I'm excited about this one, ladies and gentlemen. Please welcome Brandel Chambly to the program. Brandel, thanks for coming on.
Hey, Brett. Thanks so much for having me. Looking forward to it. And there's no shortage of things to talk about after every Masters, but I feel like in particular this one is pretty juicy.
Pretty awesome. For those out there that aren't the hardcore golf fans, now I am, so this isn't for me. Explain to the audience all the years you've been going there. I think you played in the Masters in 1999. Why is it just so special?
Well, there's no other place that's, I think, is aesthetically shocking. There's no other word for it. When you get on those grounds, you are just – I've never met anybody that went there, regardless of the hype, that didn't say that the place exceeded the hype from an aesthetic standpoint. And then there's the history of it. I think everybody who gets on the grounds, because it's in April and there's really – you know, football's not – there's not a lot of other sports competing with it. So they've got a captive audience. So people know the history of the place, and every shot has context. And that's it. That's enough. And it's springtime. You know, a lot of people are still stuck in their houses up in the Northeast, and it's cold, and they look at it, and it's the prettiest spot on earth. And it's given us so many thrilling finishes. It's been the greatest stage for the best golfers of all time to show off. Tiger winning by 12, Jack in 86, Tiger 2019. And there's just been more, I think, indelible moments there than any other place in golf.
So would you say it's the venue more than the event or a combo? I'm trying to draw a parallel to the world of baseball. And yes, it's special going and playing a day game at Wrigley Field, going to Fenway. Yeah. I didn't particularly That's like right. Fenway because it got me out of my shell. That fence was too close to me in left field. But what I remember about playing in the postseason in a World Series at the old Yankee Stadium, not the new one, was just you could close your eyes and you knew you were somewhere special. So, yeah, of course, the World Series for me, very important, an unbelievable experience. But for me, the venue, old Yankee Stadium, I remember I was on this. I came out, you know, 15 minutes before the game like I normally do. And I just run a couple sprints down the left field line. And I remember my first World Series at Yankee Stadium. I mean, I played in Yankee Stadium 50 times. It's not a big deal, right? But this was bigger. It was game three. And I had to get off the field, go into the locker room and gather myself before the first pitch. Cause it was just different.
When you get to those stadiums, Brett, do you walk in there and do you think about all the absolute legends that walk through the gates that you walk through, sat in the dugout you sat in and knocked it out of the park. I mean, do you think about that? Do the ghosts kind of come back there?
I'll tell you, I had more rude awakenings at that field than I care to share. We got whooped. My Braves got whooped there. I got heartbroken in 2001 with my Mariners that were there for the ALCS. But I'll tell you, and we've had this conversation. I had a friend of mine, Paul Konerko, who's the first baseman for the White Sox, and we had this exact conversation about really taking in what you got to do for a living and smelling the roses. And he had a pretty interesting answer to me. And it made me think about it. He said, Brett, I think for us to do what we did at the level we do it in baseball, especially because it's 162 and you never get a break. He said, if we would have really taken the time to take everything in, I don't think we'd be able to be the players that we were. And it made a great point. I remember, Randall, at the end of my career, and I kind of, you know, for the first time in my life, because when I grew up playing this game, and I thought, I'm just going to play this game until I die. I mean, that's all I've ever done. I grew up in a family where my dad played his entire career. And I, you know, he didn't retire till I was in the minor leagues. So it's all I ever knew. But at the very end, when it started to creep in, like, you know, this might be the last time I get to go to Fenway Park. And I've been playing all these years and just kind of, not that I took it for granted, but as players were there, you know, back in those times, I'm thinking, I don't really care about Fenway Park because my swing stinks and I got to face Pedro tomorrow and I got Clemens on Sunday. I didn't have time to sit there and just look and think, wow, my grandpa played here in 1954. I never thought about that until and then it all sunk in.
Right. But the thing I guess that's different about the Masters is the Masters invites back past winners to play in the event. So, you know, there you are with those legends. And it's not that you're right. You couldn't play in the Masters if you spent your time out there thinking about all the greats and the shots ahead. You just got to be in the moment. Of course you are as an athlete. But before you go out, you run into Jack Nicklaus and you used to run into Arnold Palmer and you used to run into Gene Sarazen. I remember when I played in 1999, I'm eating breakfast. I'm looking out the window at Gene Sarazen hitting a tee shot, the opening tee shot. And, you know, Gene's one of the five guys that won the career Grand Slam. You're thinking, this guy won the Masters in 1935, and it's 1999, and I'm looking right at him out there. He's, you know, and it adds to the allure and to the reverence of the place. And I've never met a fan, I've never met a spectator that didn't go there and come away blown away by the splendor, the absolute technicolor splendor of the place. But that's the beauty of it. But the strategic side of it is that it provides this great risk reward opportunity almost all the way through that golf course. So players are teased to take risk, and that's exciting. You know, if they're not all playing by the numbers and they're taking risks, it's exciting. And it happens every single year. It happened yesterday. Guys were taking risks. They were getting greedy afterwards. You know, there were a couple of players that said they got too greedy. And it just ends up giving the audience the most exciting finish without fail almost every year in the majors.
And I'll share with the fans out there right now, we were talking off camera before this podcast started, and you made an interesting point. The par three, I think it's 12.
That's right.
You said more dreams. Well, you didn't say it exactly this way. More dreams have been shattered on that hole than probably any hole in the history of golf. I saw it 2019 when Tiger had that miraculous comeback and ended up winning. Everybody in his group screwed up on that hole. Tiger hit the safe shot, ended up going on to win that Masters. But I'm in awe of it because I'm such a golf fan, and in between the baseball activities I do and chasing kids around, man, that Masters, I was up at 4:30. I'm on the West Coast. So when Tiger had to go out day two, he was teeing off like 4:45 my time. I was up at 4:30. I was on my app watching the coverage. I love that. Yeah. I love the big, especially the majors. I love watching, but at this stage of my life, because golf's always been a hobby of mine and I love it and I know how hard it is, I love playing, watching the big boys and how they hit shots. And those first 2 days you were there, I'm watching the greatest players on earth, not worrying about making a birdie on that. They're worried about hitting the surface. And I'm thinking, Wow. If Scheffler's got to worry about hitting a par three in regulation, I could imagine what the conditions were like this week.
Yeah, that's an interesting hole. You know, it sits at a diagonal to the players. So let's say it sits at maybe, you know, like 8 o'clock to 1 o'clock, or maybe even, yeah, about 8 o'clock to 2 o'clock, somewhere in there it sets at. So it sits at a diagonal, and it's a real thin green, and the water's at a diagonal. And if you're a right-handed golfer with a short iron, if you get quick, you get a little nervous, you get quick, you'll come out of it, you'll miss it to the right, and you won't have as much heat on it. So it's more of an oblique blow. So it's going to come up short. It's going to hit that bank. It's going to come in the water. And if you try to hit it at the middle of the green and you get it, you pull it just a little bit, well, now you go in the back bushes, which is what happened to Colin Mark, which is what happened to Max Homa yesterday. So, you know, there's just so many demons there, and it's just a flick wedge or a 9 iron or an 8 iron at the most. And it's harrowing. It keeps players up at night for sure. And we have seen, you know, Jordan Spieth in 2016, he had won the Masters in 2015. He stood on the 12th tee and he had a 4-shot lead, I believe. And I think he dunked 2 in the water there, made a mess of it. And he's not the only person that's done that. Of course, you alluded to 2019. So that's known as Amen Corner, that little spot. I don't know why they call it Amen Corner, because I imagine more people have cursed the heavens there than genuflected. But it's always exciting. And it was yesterday as well. I mean, it was, everybody came unraveled, but Scottie Scheffler yesterday, in a span of like 3 holes.
Watching Tiger. Now when Tiger was young, we grew up, he was a neighbor of mine. I was down at Isleworth, was my home.
Is that right?
And so I watched Tiger from a young kid. Like when the first time we met, he called me dude. And I said, wait a minute. I'm not dude. I was already a member, and he came out and he was the talk, like, hey, that's the next. And of course he's done what he's done in the game. I know what it's like to get a little bit older. I know what it's like to go through injuries, maybe not to the extent that Tiger has, but coming out having pretty much no competitive rounds this year, to go to the Masters, those conditions on top of it, I was kind of really impressed the way he was grinding about as hard as he could grind those first days. And to make the cut, then to follow it up with probably maybe the worst round of his career. Yeah. What are you seeing at this stage? You've seen the whole movie. Arguably, in my mind, I wasn't there early to watch Jack, but this is the greatest I've ever seen. And when I used to just go around, and once in a while, you know, they invite, if they want to slum it, those pros, they invite the baseball players to go out and play 9 holes with them once in a while. That was my heyday, Brandel, to play with you guys and to watch you hit it. You know, it's probably that way for every sport. We love watching the other sports, because we don't know how they do it. Tiger came out. He's good buddies with John Smoltz. In my year I was with the Braves, we trained right there at Disney. And he took Tiger out to hit batting practice.
So Tiger, he did?
Yeah. So Tiger's got this helmet on. He looks like Kazoo. And I'm laughing at him. He steps in the cage and, you know, he just got a coach throwing BP. And Tiger can't hit a ball out of the dirt. And he comes up to me after. He goes, Booney, he goes, man, I didn't realize how much power is involved in the baseball swing. And I looked at him. I started laughing. I said, it's not, Tiger. It's technique. I said, and you ain't got it. I said, but now you know how I feel standing over a wedge. And he laughed. Yeah. But that's the greatness really cool. of going to different sports. You're in awe. You go to a courtside game, you know, watch an NBA game courtside, and you're just like, how do they do that? Whereas what we do for a living, we just do it, and we don't think it's a big deal.
Man, I have such an appreciation for, you know, other athletes. When I was in college at the University of Texas, I was on the same floor as the tennis team and the football team. So, you know, I'd go out. I thought I was a pretty good tennis player. I'd go out. I mean, you can't return these serves from these guys. And then, you know, watching, you know, I lived in this area where there were loads of baseball players a few years ago. Before he passed away, Bob Welch was my next door neighbor.
Yeah.
Mike Gallego was right down the street. Willie Mays had a house about 5 doors down from me. He came during spring training, so I would run into Willie a few times here and there. And I would watch, you know, go to spring training and watch. And I can't even imagine trying to hit it just an 80 mile an hour pitch. I mean, I can't even imagine. Now you guys are throwing 95, 100, you know, 100 miles an hour. I can't even imagine. Did Tiger even get a bat on a pitch?
Yeah, he did. I mean, it was just a coach just throwing batting cracks.
How fast would he be throwing? And be
65.
Oh, okay.
So basically, he's put, you know, we're at the range right now. We're just ripping drivers.
Yeah.
So that's what, you know, we're basically putting it on a tee, which is what we want before a game. You know, when you go to the range before a tour event, and I know you're not there to work on your game. You're there to get to that swing, to get to the first tee. Your work is done when work is done, like us. You've hitting batting practice in the off season. Working on things, that's one thing. Before each and every game, I just want to go out there and get a good feel, be out on the field, get my surroundings in, and I want to feel good. So just lay it in there so I come out of there feeling good about myself. Same thing. So that's BP. So no, this was just basic, and I'm watching him. This is the greatest person to ever pick up a golf club, and he can't get a ball airborne.
Which is amazing. You know, because I think the baseball swing, I go online a lot and look at baseball swings to make analogies with golf swings, you know, and because power has become more prevalent in the sport in golf than it's ever been, thanks to Tiger, there's better athletes, bigger athletes, and they're emphasizing power moves over precise moves or precision moves. So when I watch Barry Bonds, it's, you know, I can make analogies to, say, Cameron Young's golf swing. You know, I can make analogies to Minwoo Lee's golf swing. When you see where Barry Bonds is, you know, with his, you know, a couple of clicks before impact, it looks very much like a Minwoo Lee. When you see somebody come along who's Minwoo's, he's 5'9", 160, and he's got, he can touch 130 club head speed. Mm-hmm. That means he can get close to 190 ball speed. I mean, that's a home run hitter, big time home run hitter. And you look and you put Barry Bonds up face on, flip him around, and you put Minwoo up, and they get in the same positions. So that's unique to golf. Guys didn't used to swing like that. So, you know, y'all's game, it seems to me, I'm certainly not even close to an expert, but it seems to me that power has become, home runs have become more a part of baseball because of TrackMan. And it's the same in golf. And you see more and more guys in golf looking like home run hitters.
I think it's true that there is an emphasis now on my tenure was, you looked at average, you looked at home runs, you looked at RBIs, and that's how you're paid accordingly. Now
that's how you're paid.
Right. That was, you know, me through the early 2000s, but now it's kind of, and I'm going to get into that a little bit with you about the data and the analytics that have always, you know, kind of gone to golf first, but they're bringing them into Major League Baseball now. But nowadays, baseball is all about plate discipline and controlling the strike zone. So OPS has become a huge factor when how you're judged as a hitter. So it becomes power, OPS. So as time goes on, I'm starting to embrace these analytics a little bit more, because for my generation, it was no, strikeouts aren't acceptable. They're embarrassing. Well, now it's become an acceptable metric. Like if you strike out, that's fine. But if your on-base percentage correlates to X, then it works out. Well, no, I go crazy. You know, I struck out 100 times a year and I felt like I struck out every at bat. These guys are going back to the dugout 200 times. And I'm going, I don't know what I do. I don't know if I can live with myself, but that's just how the game's changed. Everything is a metric now. Exit velocity. We didn't have that when I played. You know what exit velocity, if that ball landed 10 rows in the seats, that's good exit velocity. That was our metric at the time. Now, it's 93. And I have a son that's in the minor leagues, and we'll go, you know, I'll go down to the cage with him, and he's working out with other pro players. And they've got everything up there on the big screen at these cages. And I'd say, buddy, you got to not look at these all the time, because let's say your average exit velocity in a batting practice session is 93. Well, you just went around, you moved the ball around the cage and you came out, you know, was that a good session? Yeah, that was really good, Dad. Okay. Now we're looking at the metrics. Well, your average exit velocity today was 91. All of a sudden, his brain, well, normally it's 93, it's 94. You just had a great session, and you're driving home in the car wondering why you were off today instead of having that good feeling. So I'm for metrics. I'm for analysis. I'm for all the information you can give me as a hitter so I can formulate a plan for the next day. But I think, how do I put this? I think sometimes too much information in the wrong hands can be detrimental to the end goal.
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir here.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Earthquake of data. It just rains data on tour players now. And, you know, you see the guys on the range, they hit a shot and they hardly watch it. They just look down at the screen.
Yeah. I noticed that with tour players now more than ever.
Yeah. They just look down at the screen. And, you know, like Scotty Scheffler doesn't do that. I don't see him doing that. I mean, I'm sure he knows his data. I'm sure at some point he's zeroed in his data, but he's not doing that every time he looks at the golf ball. And his numbers are not insane. You know, his ball speed's not off the charts. His spin rate is not as low as a lot of guys are seeking. His trajectory is not as high as a lot of the numbers that guys are seeking. And yet he's beating the hell out of them. And he's beating them because he, to your point, he can move it around. He can hit all nine shots. All nine shots that Tiger Woods always worked on. You know, Tiger wouldn't have fit perfectly in this era. You know, Tiger is the most dominant player in the history of the game, the best player in the history of the game by a mile. And he had high spin, not low spin. Everybody's looking for low spin now. And because teachers can easily tell you how to hit it far. High launch, low spin. And that's great. But none of them will say, well, okay, then the opposite should be true for control. Low launch, high spin. But nobody teaches low launch, high spin. Nobody. But there is a happy medium in there. And Tiger, I think he found it intuitively, which was, why would I want a golf ball flying through the air that was slippery, you know, that could get out of play? Tiger was very much about power, but he was also very much about control. He had high spin, higher than normal spin, and some of the highest spin on tour. And so did Phil Mickelson for a while. In this new era, very few players play with higher spin. They're all trying to get as little spin as they can so they can maximize distance. And I think it's a mistake for the most part.
I'll tell you, I just was out. I'm in San Diego, so I was just at the Kingdom. Oh. I was just at the Kingdom recently getting some new clubs.
That's a great spot.
So they're giving me. You're right. They're like, well, Brett. What I said? What do you want me to do? They said, I want you to hit some balls. And I'm in the back, you know, in one of those rooms, and I'm ripping balls. All right, rip it a little more. They're getting all these numbers. I have no clue, Brandel, what any of these numbers mean. Now they take me out to the range. And he's like, well, you ever think about changing your grip? Because I have a real weak grip. Baseball, I manipulate the club. I play a cut, hook, whatever. But it's all with my hands, which gets me in a lot of trouble. That's why my spread with my handicap is all over the place. I shoot 75 one day, and the next day I shoot 86. So I either beat your brains in the money game, or I get my brains beat in. But but they're talking to me, you want to change your grip. And if you're going to change your grip to a more traditional, that's going to help you. If you work on it, you're going to be a better player. But then I got to set you with a different set of clubs that I want for this new grip. Yeah. So I'm going through all these things. They're giving me these numbers. And they're like, see that number? That's a bad number. You want to get it to this number. So I finally, I just found it while you were talking. So my ball speed was 177.
Your ball speed was 177?
My carry was 302, and my club speed was 120.6, and my spin rate was 2786. Total distance, 318. And he gave it, and he circled them. I don't know if you can see
it. Anyway. I can see it, yeah.
Oh, okay. He circled them, and he goes, Booney, this is what you want to be. This is good for you. That's what works.
Good stuff.
And I said, how the hell do you do that? And I go out, you know, I go out with these new clubs, and I'm still in the middle of my grip change. And I can see my contacts getting a lot better. I mean, I've been a golf rat forever. I never practice, but I just love going out and playing with my buddies and taking my chances. But I've always had kind of a baseball swing, and, you know, I'm at a high handicap right now for me. But I can make some money if I'm playing good. I'm at an 8 now or 7-8 index.
That's pretty good.
And all my buddies that I play with, they're all better players than me. And I'm just the hack in the group. But on that given day, I can go low. And they're like, you know, if you play with me and I have a good day, like, wait a minute, how are you a 7-8? I said, stick around a little bit and you'll see. Because I can get wayward.
But if you've got 120 mile an hour club head speed, I mean, that's elite club head speed for touring professionals. I've hardly ever met a baseball player.
Well, I'm old now. I'm old.
Well, how old are you? How old are you?
55.
Damn, that's amazing club head speed for somebody 55. I used to play a fair bit. You know who Kurt Young is? Pitching coach.
Did you say Fairbanks Ranch?
I have not played there.
Oh,
no.
Okay.
No, I haven't played there. But, I mean, I was just saying for 55, that's a hell of a club head speed. You know, I mean, that's elite for tour players. But, again, I've not played with many baseball players that weren't good at golf. You know, it's a similar move. They got great hand eye coordination, you know, and they can launch it for the most part. You know, I don't think the inverse is true. I played little league, but I don't think I could get out there and play as good a golf as you, or as good a baseball as you do golf. I can tell you that.
That's right. I tease golfers. I said, you're not really athletes, you know.
Yeah,
you
right.
You have an elite skill. I said, but I can hit my drive past you.
And that's
you
right.
You can win a tournament tomorrow. I used to play with Lee Jansen all the time.
Uh-huh.
And I'd hit a one iron off the tee. And this is back where he's playing those. They were Brown TaylorMade. So we're talking late 90s, middle 90s.
Yeah.
And I would hit this old ping one iron and I'd hit it past his driver and he'd look at me and I'd look at him. I said, Lee, you got to start hitting these irons, man. They're really long. And he'd look at me like, all right, Booney. He goes, let's see how we do from there. And that's what I'm talking about. Just playing with you guys, tour caliber players. It's really a treat for us because we sit out there and we bang balls, but we watch the craft done at the highest level. I'm still, every time I get a chance, and I never used to bug the guys because at Iowa, we had a lot of guys. O'Meara was out there
like
a bunch of guys.
And
I never bugged them because I thought, you know, they have a job to do. They're getting ready for this tournament. They don't need some hack going around with them. It's just like if I took somebody to the cage to get somewhere, it'd be fine once in a while. But when you're there all the time, it's like, hey, I got some work to do here. So anytime I'd get a call, hey, Booney, you want to play nine holes? I was there
because there.
I get to watch this.
Yeah,
you know, these guys play at that level. It's awesome.
But when you go, you talk about Lee Jansen. I mean, Lee Jansen was kind of my era. I mean, the game's changed so much thanks to Tiger. It was a skill then. It was a game then, and it is a sport now. Yeah. When you go out there now, you know, the guys are 6'2", they're 6'3", they're, you know, their BMI is elite level, they're ripped, and they're looking to swing, you know, guys are swinging 125, sneaking up to 130 now, and it's coming. You know, my wife and I were at an event not long ago, and I ran into, I don't know if you know the name Billy Andre, but I ran into Billy Andre,
yes.
I ran into Mark Brooks, I ran into Willie Wood, who are sort of, you know, my peers, and they're all 5'9", like I am. And I walked away and I said to my wife, Bailey, I was like, that's what tour players used to look like. Now they look like Michael Phelps. You know,
it's unbelievable. Is Andrade in Atlanta?
Andrade is in Atlanta. Yeah.
He used to come when I played for the Braves. We had a putting green and a little chipping center inside our clubhouse. Andrade used to come down there and play.
Oh, yeah.
I remember Billy.
Yeah.
You say that though about the tour players. I'm with you because I look at the, you know, I'm 5'10 on a really good day. And back when I was playing, I tell my wife all the time, I said, you know, I'd get into the elevator after a game and you know, the starting pitchers are around, they're always 6'3", 6'4". So I always knew, you know, I was on the shorter side, but right now I'll walk into the Yankees locker room. I feel like a little tiny man. And it's like the guys, I don't remember the guys 15 years ago being as big as they are. Probably similar thing going on with you in the tour.
Oh, 100%. You know, I go out on the range now and I just look and, I mean, everybody's ripped. When I played, you know, you'd walk down the range and half of them looked like plumbers. You know, dad bods everywhere. Now you go on the range, I mean, these guys are so fit and they're sending it. Absolutely. Same thing, I guess. The little I read about baseball, the number of people that throw 95 plus is off the charts.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, the data is changing baseball and the metrics are changing baseball. And some say it's for the better. Some say it's for the worse. And I think the same thing is analogous to golf. Some say it's for the better. Some say it's for the worse. You know, there's so much coaching in golf. Like, I'll give you, you know, there's a couple of people in there. They think you've just got to hit it one way. You can't, you know, just concentrate on one flight. That's it. And because if you try and fly it another direction, you know, you're more apt to have your dispersion cone gets bigger and you miss it more, and they can make all that argument. And I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. I get it. That's a way to limit mistakes, but that's not what the best of all time have done. You know, I don't know if it's directly analogous to a pitcher not having, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 pitches that he just masters. I don't know. I've read about Yamamoto and it's like, you know, he's got every pitch. Maybe that is a fair analogy to guys needing to be able to work the ball around in the game of golf?
I think so. And it, to me though, it's more to that you have to keep up on rather than keeping it really simple. I mean, for me, it was always, I didn't care how many pitches they had. It's what kind of pitch they have. They have an elite fastball and an elite off speed pitch. That was enough. You didn't need three elite, you know, the ability to subtract sometimes when the brain tells you to add big count, big situation, 3-1, 2-0. The old school is, I'm going to really reach back for some more here. Well, as a hitter, 3-1, 2-0, I'm waiting for you to reach back for some more. The ability to subtract in those situations, I felt was much tougher as a hitter to put the ball in the barrel. And the great ones, you know, the Maddoxes of the world, they had the ability, you know, they're 93, 92, 93 all day, 3-1, 2-0, to get you off the barrel, he might throw you that same pitch, same shape, 86, 87. Well, that's 5 miles an hour. That's just enough to get me from really revved up and I'm going to get you to just off the barrel, which results in an easy out for him. I thought those were the guys that were the best at it.
Let me ask you this. Could Greg Maddux, by the way, I played with Greg Maddux in the AT&T a couple
of
years.
Pretty good play. He's a pretty good golfer. He's kind of good. He's good at everything. He'll beat you in ping pong, pool, whatever you need, darts.
Yeah, right. He just got that competitive gene. When I read about the way pitching is going today, I mean, could a Greg Maddux come along today and would the scouts look at him and go, this guy's elite? Or would they dismiss him because his numbers are not high enough?
Well, I think if you're a Maddux type, he's never going to be eliminated from the process.
Who's the equivalent of a Maddux in baseball today? I mean, I realize there's no equivalent to Maddux, but who's closest to Maddux?
Hendricks for the Chicago Cubs.
Okay.
What Maddux had the ability to do, and for me, Randall, I mean, Randy Johnson's one of the best. Pedro, Maddux, Smoltz, Glavine, Clemens. Yeah, they're all great. For my money, body of work day in and day out facing him, he's the greatest I've ever seen. Because he was more than a pitcher, he was a technician. His misses were a couple inches. Whereas a normal person, when they're having an off day and you call for a fastball away, they might miss up and in. Maddox is missing by inches. And then I got to play behind him 1 year and I was in awe. His bad game in his heyday was 7 innings, 2 runs. And that was like rough. And I knew what it was like on the other side. It was just, he was throwing a different ball than everybody else. And it was so precise. He could hit his spots. And then all of a sudden he'd see an umpire that would give him a little bit off the plate. Well, the ability to throw that same pitch an inch off the plate with precision, he was unbelievable. The biggest misnomer with him is, oh, Maddox didn't throw that hard. Let me tell you, Maddox in his day, he could get up to 93, 94 anytime he wanted.
Is that right?
And he had more movement on his ball and what we call a heavy ball. Some guys throw a light ball, and I don't care if you're throwing 98. If you're throwing a light ball, we want to see it. It seems to come in just softer. It flies off your bat. Maddox, for whatever reason, I used to tease him because he's got these little tiny hands.
Come on.
Like, that's why your sinker is so weird and it's so heavy. It's like it would reverberate. Even though I'd hit it on the barrel, it would feel like I was hitting a weighted ball. And I'm like, I don't even know what to do with that. Most guys, you think you get a pitch out over the plate and I'm going to take you deep. I didn't even think about hitting a home run off Greg. After a while, I'm like, I just want to take my base hit and move on from this, because that ball for me is just too heavy to lift. And he's something I've never seen it one time. Like I said, I've faced all the great guys from my generation and a lot. There's a lot of great ones. But day in and day out, for my money, he's the greatest pitcher I've ever seen. And nobody's even, I don't even know if I put anybody in his category. He was that good and that precise.
Well, I'd love to go on YouTube and watch his highlights. You know, he was talking about a couple of pitches he threw Again, the curveballs, I'm like, is that real? That wasn't like computer generated, that curve. He was like, well, the ball was scuffed up a little bit. He knew it was.
Yeah, he's self-deprecating, but at the same time, yeah, hey, I'm Maddox. Like,
and so in golf, if a Maddox came along, the equivalent of Maddox, and of course, Tiger sounds like he's the equivalent of Maddox, everybody would be studying Tiger swing, Maddox swing. So in baseball, do people study his throwing motion? Do they just get it
I
out?
Think so. It's so repeatable, and he repeated it so well. I mean, that's what a lot of guys have the velocity, the physical, but the ability to repeat, it makes the difference for me at the highest level. The ability to repeat, anybody can do it for a minute if you've got a lot of physical. But can you do it consistently over the long? And that's what I found the great ones do. And to my point, Maddox did better than all the great ones.
Wow. Yeah. Now you've encouraged me to go back and even watch more of him. I found him to be such a.
Don't tell him I said it, because he knows I think he's great. And it's tough. It's tough because he was my locker mate. We drove to the ballpark every day. And
oh, no kidding.
He used to. I've told this story before. We'd sit there, and Bobby Cox had a different way. We'd go over the hitters and the pitchers meeting at the same time. Most of the teams I'm on, before each series, we'll go in. The hitters will go in for a hitters meeting. Pitchers have their own separate. We don't like pitchers anyway. But Bobby Cox used to have us all together, and we'd have that's the way he did it in Atlanta. And Greg would be sitting next to me, and let's say he was pitching that day. I mean, he was a student of the game. He wasn't out there doing all the exercises, but he really studied in between starts. And every once in a while, he'd slip me a piece of paper during the meeting. And he'd go, hey, Booney, he goes, aren't you glad you're on my team now? And he'd give me a piece of paper with my stats against him. So that's our relationship right there, just so you know. So don't tell him.
Throwing a little shade at you.
Oh, always, always. That's what Greg did.
Well, yeah, I saw him once being interviewed. I saw this recently where he was talking about who he hated to pitch to, or who was, maybe it was just how he pitched to Barry Bonds. And you've probably seen this too on social media. He goes, well, actually Barry Bonds was the easiest guy to pitch to. He goes, cause if it mattered at all, you just walked him.
Yeah.
He goes, because you got to pick your battles. And he goes, that guy was that good. You know,
he was the, at least the equivalent to Barry on the hitter side. I mean, to Greg on the hitter side.
Yeah.
And to this day, people don't understand. Unless you were there, I've never seen anyone even close. Not even close.
His swing's unbelievable.
It's like he was playing slow pitch softball and the rest of us were playing big league baseball. I'll give you a quick one about Barry, and I didn't like him at all. We intentionally walked him, Brandel, with the bases empty in the ninth inning in a one-run ball game. Intentionally walked him, nobody on, nobody out, because we thought that much he was going to hit a home run. This is like video game stuff.
That's crazy.
He steals second base, and I walk over to him, and I don't want to say it, but I have to say it. And I said, Barry? And he goes, yeah. I said, I've seen a lot of things. I said, intentional walk with nobody on base in a one-run game, knowing full well you're going to steal second. I said, that's impressive. I've seen a lot of things. That's impressive. And you know what he did? He took his helmet off and he goes, Booney, I'd have done the same shit. I had no answer. I'm like, I can't stand you, and you're right. You're that good. So to this day, I'm in awe. People talk about who's the greatest ever. And I said, I don't think you have you had to live with Barry to know how much better he was than everybody. And, you know, the Manny Ramirez's, and I watch a Mike Trout of today and the great players of today. I said, it was just different with Barry. I mean, he was breaking Babe Ruth's records. You're breaking his records.
Right.
It's like you're on to something. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, see it swings and they're like, this is the fastest a bat has ever been swung.
Yeah.
I mean, the way it exits, I just think, God, who swings a golf club like that? You know, it's incredible movement he had. And I go online and look at it all the time, trying to draw comparisons to golf swings.
The Tiger you saw this week.
Yeah.
And Phil, for that matter. What do you think going forward we can expect level of play?
Well, Tiger's just too banged up. I hope I'm wrong. I hope he finds some sweet spot of painless golf. But he just looks hobbled. You know, 4 days is it's tough on him. I think it just takes so much for him when he finishes a round to recover and then get ready for the next round. He's got another 2 hours on the back end and 2 hours on the front end of every round he plays golf. And he's 48 years old. I mean, 48-year-old golfers generally don't do very good, even if they're healthy. It's the rare exception. So, you know, he says he's going to play the PGA, the U.S. Open, and the Open. I hope he does. It wouldn't surprise me if he made all those cuts, but it would really surprise me if he contended in any of them. He's just not healthy enough. He's still got the grit. Still got the grind. It's amazing to watch him work his way around a golf course with about 1/20th of the physical skills that he used to have. And he can still hit shots that make his peers sort of marvel at him. He's still capable. They're not long as they used to. They're not even close to being as long. His last year at the Masters before he turned pro, he averaged 345 yards off the tee at the Masters. The next closest was 306. He averaged so that's Barry Bonds stuff, 345. That was in 1996. He turned pro and then won it by 12 in 97. When he was sinewy and not bulky, he swung faster. He got bulky, went to the gym and got bulky. Maybe it helped him out of the rough. Maybe it helped him be intimidating because he struck such a physical, imposing posture. But I've always argued that it didn't help his golf. He swung faster before. He was sinewy before. I think the bulk, I think it contributed to his injuries. He was obsessed with the gym. And I think those injuries and him changing his golf swing kept him from breaking Jack Nicklaus's record of 18 majors. He's at 15, Jack's at 18. I think he would have blown by Jack's major championship record. I think he'd have got to 25. I think he would have gotten into 100 PGA Tour wins. Even having said that, though, he's still the most dominant and the best player ever, and he's been meant more to golf than any other figure in the history of the game. So every time he plays, I think I'm watching Babe Ruth at the end of his career. And the whole golf world is still reveres him and still loves him. Phil, on the other hand, is a sad figure. He had the world of golf in the palm of his hand. He was still doing great things, late 40s, early 50s. And he just absolutely destroyed his legacy. He was walking up to greens at Augusta National and getting no applause. The last hole at Augusta, they faintly applauded as he was walking up 18. And when he got about 20 yards from the green, they all stopped, didn't applaud. Tiger Woods, standing ovations everywhere he goes. And Phil's a three-time winner there, six-time major winner. You know, it's sad to see Phil in the state that he's in.
And he's a guy, I mean, Phil's a guy, he's got 40-plus PGA Tour wins. I mean, this is the top player of all time. And if Tiger wasn't in this era, the best of this generation.
Yeah, look, I mean, I don't see Phil that way. And I don't say that because of what's happened. I've never put Phil in the top 10 all time. I would put him top 20. You know, Phil was never the number one player in the world. He never had the lowest scoring average. He never won the money title, never was player of the year. And in that era, Tiger's era, David Duvall did that. Ernie Els did that. Vijay Singh did that. You know, Phil was just, he was very good. I mean, he's very good. And, you know, look, again, I mean, not top 10. Top 10 is how, I mean, that's, who's he going to knock out if he's in the top 10? But he's certainly close. And more than that, though, the fans loved him. Now, within the sport, the players didn't because they knew him. But, you know, 1 year on tour, he got voted least popular player on tour in a poll. But the fans loved him because he looked like he was, you know, signing autographs till dark every night. But, you know, he's lost the fan base now completely because he tried to burn the game of golf down to the ground. And I don't know that he'll ever recover. I mean, maybe he will if he comes back with some humility and is more conciliatory. But I don't know that that's in him. And it's too bad because I sure enjoyed watching him play. And I thought he would have moved into the TV booth and probably would have been great.
He was really good. I saw him I forget what it was, but he was really good in the booth.
Yeah, he popped in at the PGA when it was at Harding Park in 2020. And he was great. I mean, Phil is, you know, he's a smart guy. He studies the game. He knows it great. You know, at the time, Tony Romo was all that. And there was a sense that Phil was going to be like Tony Romo, get in the booth and be this, you know, prescient soothsayer up there. And, you know, he would have made $20 to $40 million a year until he was 80 years old. And he would have probably, if I went X's and O's all the way through it, he would probably made more money than he got paid to go to live. And he would have had an amazing legacy. So it's really sad to see the deterioration of Phil when he's out on the golf course now.
It was interesting, too, because I kind of made note of that. I didn't hear, you know, I always check Mickelson's box score, see what he's doing, because I'm always interested. And especially when guys get older, it's how impressive it is to walk around. It's a young man's game. And you mentioned before, people don't think of golf as this big physical thing. But I tell them, as a guy that loves to play golf and I'm always in a golf cart, you know, I have days where I get to go to some fun courses and we walk the course. But competitively, when you have to do that day after day after day, I don't think people that are casual golfers really understand what it's like to every week. No, you're walking all four rounds, and you're not just walking stress-free rounds with a $10 Nassau with your buddy. These are world-class rounds. So I do have an appreciation for the physical when it comes to competing at the highest level and having to walk those facilities.
Yeah, look, I mean, the sport is – what's cool about golf is it's not just about how far you hit it. It's also about how soft you can hit it. So, you know, you've got to have brawn and you've got to have touch to play it at the highest level. So, you know, as you get older and you go to the gym, you can still maintain that power. But if your nerves are just not as good, and it's rare when a player maintains his nerves as he gets older. And Phil, by all accounts, still had his nerves and his touch at 50 years of age. I mean, he won the PGA Championship when he was almost 51, yeah. The oldest player to ever win a major championship. So he was incredible to watch. And he's, you know, I mean, now he's 50, what is he, 53, 54? But, you know, he's nowhere near the player he was. He's lost his game. And I think a lot of that has to do with they went to the league, the Saudi league, and the competition isn't as tough. You know, there were 13 live players in the Masters, and they were 82 over par for the week. You know, they were all of them, almost all of them, of the 13 that were there, all but one of them, their game had pretty much deteriorated. One of them, Cameron Smith, came in, and it was hard to say whether his game was better or worse. There were a few of them that played okay there. John Rahm played awful. Brooks Koepka played awful. Dustin Johnson played awful. You know, the guys that you thought might play well. So, you know, Phil's gone off to live. Who knows? Phil could have probably won tour events if he'd have stayed on the tour when he was 52, 53, 54 years old. He was, yeah, an absolute medical miracle out there. But no more. That game seems to be gone, unfortunately.
What has to happen? What's your view? What has to happen with being the golf fan? Me, I want to see the best players in the world.
Yeah,
I don't want too. I don't want two different leagues. Now, right. There's been a lot. Now, the purses have been up because of it. I don't know though. I don't like. And I'm not all for it. I don't like the music. Maybe this generation does. The music, the shorts. I'm a purist. I like the long pants. I like Quiet Please. Even though as an athlete, I don't know why they're allowed to talk about my mom when I'm hitting, but they can't say anything to a golfer. So I think about that a little bit. But I kind of like the purist. It's a gentleman's sport. I like the long pants when you're a tour player. I don't care if you're out there with me hacking on Tuesday with shorts on. But when the game is played, that would be like baseball players coming out in shorts. I know the
right.
Tops try that right. Once. But that's not what big leaguers do. I don't like that part. Maybe the new generation does. Who knows? Maybe the millennials like that action, music. I still don't like music playing in my group. When I'm playing a casual round on Tuesday, I just don't. I don't mind a little bit. I mean, I'm not going to complain, but I don't like the loud. What has to happen, your opinion, what has to happen with these two tours? Because the Saudis obviously have a ton of money. What has to happen to get this game united as one to get the best players, no matter where they are, competing on the weekend?
I don't know if it's possible for the tours to come together. They pretended, in my view, I could be dead wrong, but it seemed to me that all they really wanted to do with a proposed merger was end the litigation and end the discovery. I think there was probably some edginess on both sides as it came to discovery. And the proposed merger did that. But here we are sneaking up on a year later since the proposed merger was announced, and they're no closer to it. I just don't think it's going to happen. And even if they did come to some agreement, the Department of Justice, I just can't imagine them saying that this passes muster. This would reek of a monopoly. So I just can't imagine that DOJ would pass muster, would allow it to go through. So I don't know that it will happen. So having said that, I think the tour now with private equity, they've got billions of dollars ready to go for a for-profit aspect of the tour, and they're just ready to compete. I think they've just got to the point where like, okay, let's compete. You guys want to go play LIV, and you guys want to go, you know, play in Mecca and Medina and Riyadh and four corners of the world where really nobody's watching you, and you're relegated to, you might as well be in the witness protection program. You know, nobody's watching you. And these guys are golfers at their core. They want to compete, and they want recognition. They want to be talked about. Whether they'll admit it or not, they want to be talked about. Nobody talks about them. Nobody. We won't see Dustin Johnson or Brooks Koepka or Phil Mickelson or John Rahm again until the U.S. Open, unfortunately. So the only time we're going to see these guys now is at the majors, as long as they can still get in them. All the Saudis did was buy a moment in time. They bought some stars, thinking that those stars are always going to have the game that made them stars. Their games deteriorate and they can no longer play. Are they still stars? They have names, but can they play? If you look at what happened at the Masters, nah, as a group, no, they can't play. They're hardly competitive. And the tour has a pipeline to create stars. So as soon as they take one away, here comes Ludwig Åberg. You know, as soon as they take one away, guess what? This Christo Lambrecht, this amateur that's 6'8", he'll come along. Or Gordon Sargent, here he comes. They'll just keep coming. You know, 4 years ago, they wouldn't have been interested in Wyndham Clark. Well, Wyndham Clark is fourth-ranked player in the world because the tour just creates stars. They've got the best pipeline. They got the PGA Tour, Latin America, China, Canada, Corn Ferry Tour. Now they've got the university program. So they're in the business of developing stars. Whereas how can the Saudis, they can't build stars. There's no golf league in Saudi Arabia. They are parasitic by nature. They have to buy stars that the tour creates. And those stars then go there. And because of the lack of competition, their game falls off. So if I'm the tour, I'm like, listen, we made an overture. I know you guys got a lot of money. And maybe you'll peck off some players here and there, but let's just compete. They got a lot of private equity money behind the PGA Tour who really love the game of golf, who have the best interest of the game of golf in mind. You know, there are a lot of American players that would be very turned off by that merger. You know, I mean, MBS, the guy behind the Saudi League, that's the leader of Saudi Arabia. I mean, 15 of the 19 hijackers that flew those planes into those buildings in 9/11 were from Saudi Arabia. And their number one export, people will say it's oil, but it's probably more Wahhabism. And so there are a lot of people, core golfers in the United States that pay for this game that would not be too happy about a merger with the Saudis playing golf. I realize the Saudis want a seat at the table. They want to get involved and invest in football and golf and whatever else. And it's hard to keep that money out because that money's everywhere. Because in a free market society, you can't keep the Saudi money out. You can't do it. But the golfers were in a pretty good position to say no. And for the most part, they did. So I don't know, Brett, if there's ever going to be a merger between these two. I just don't see it happening.
Interesting perspective, because somebody that just watching and is not on the ground, you're living it with these guys week in and week out. Yeah, so you're saying you're seeing a different side of it than I am. Something I wanted to ask you before I let you go is I'm watching Scottie Scheffler in modern times, and he's so good. And I remember, you know, my buddies were talking on Thursday, and I kept sending a text to you. I said, this Scheffler guy, it's like, he's kind of got that aura, you know. I'm not going to elevate him to Tiger-esque for that long, because nobody had that. If Tiger had the lead Saturday, you might as well not even show up. You're playing for second place. That was obvious. But I'll tell you, to a lesser degree, it's kind of that way. And I know, just as an athlete, you get there and you look in the eyes of somebody who's hot or someone that's playing the hot hand. It's like you kind of know without words that I'm in trouble with this guy on the mound today, or sometimes vice versa. He's seeming to me to have that aura right now. And I was interested, for you who's been covering these guys for so long, you saw Jack a little bit. You saw Norman when he was dominant. You obviously watched Tiger. Where do you put Scheffler right now and what he's doing?
He's got potential to be – you're right. You can't compare anybody to Tiger. They're going to be diminished. But I never thought I'd see somebody come along and hit a golf ball like Tiger again. And Scottie Scheffler's doing that. I never thought I'd see somebody come along and be predictably great again. And Scottie Scheffler's doing that. And I don't think that he will be susceptible to the same pitfalls that slowed Rory down, Rory McIlroy, slowed Jordan Spieth down, took John Rahm away from the game, and distracted Brooks Koepka. Those are the four, and Dustin Johnson. There's five players that sort of teased us with greatness, and all of them have, you know, sort of been distracted for different reasons. Scottie Scheffler, I see he's really grounded. Golf doesn't define him. He's got a great family life, but he's very competitive too. He's not satiated with victories. He's not really, I don't think money drives him. I think victories drive him. And that's what made Tiger, the larger part of what made Tiger, Tiger. After he'd win a tournament, you'd think, okay, he's probably going to relax now. No, he'd win the next one and the next one and the next one. You're like, Jesus, you know, what motivates this guy to keep trying to get better? And it was just that he wanted to kick your ass. And Scotty's got a lot of that in him. He hits the ball like Tiger did in his at his best. Tiger had all four of the aspects of the game. He was long and straight. He was precise with his irons. He could scramble like God, and he putted like a genius. Scotty Scheffler's got three of those four. His putter is decent. I'm going to say it's a click above average now. But he's the best there is off the tee. He's the best he is with his iron play. He's the best he is with around the greens. Well, that's enough to dominate. And maybe he's not the in-your-face intimidator that Tiger Woods is. But when you know he's not going to make a mistake and he wins as consistently is, that's going to intimidate. And that's the last piece of the puzzle. When a guy can absolutely intimidate those around him where his sheer presence makes them play inferior, that's the last piece of the puzzle to dominating. And Tiger had that in spades. So did Jack Nicklaus. So did Ben Hogan. Very few have had that. But Scheffler's got a chance to be that dominating, that dominant, and that intimidating.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah, I love it. I love hearing. Yeah, as you could tell, I'm kind of a golf geek, and I love.
Yeah, you are.
I love hearing it from guys like you that this is what you do. You follow these guys, and you know the nooks and crannies.
Well, I'll just
everything. I love it.
This is crazy. So when you know, predicting golf tournaments is inevitably you're going to get egg on your face. There's 156 guys out there, 144 at the Masters. It's 90. They play in different times and different variables, and it's not like predicting another sport. The difference between the best in golf and everybody else is 2-4%. And every other sport, it's like 20-30%. So it's really hard. But with Tiger, it was pretty damn simple to predict. You know, he'd show up, you'd watch him, and you'd think, who's going to beat him? And so you could go on TV and say, when asked who's going to win, you'd be like, Tiger. Well, Scotty Scheffler's kind of that way. You know, and more than that, you can look at it and you're like, wow, if he plays good, he's not just going to win. He's going to win by like 8 shots. He's that much better than everybody else right now.
And that's the case. I remember it was Friday and I checked the line. Friday, he was even money to win the tournament. Never since Tiger in his heyday has there ever been a line on Friday to win the tour on Sunday. And this is all with him saying, if my wife goes into labor, I'm out of here. Yeah, I know it's the Masters final round. I'm out of here. But that's to your point. Golf doesn't define him. He's that guy.
That's a pretty powerful place to be in. She was the only person that could stop him from winning that tournament.
That's right. you better not go into labor. Well, Brando, I really appreciate you taking the time. I know you've been busy. This is a lot of fun for me and a lot of people out there listening to the Boone podcast. I'm a big fan. I will be watching you and all the rest of the majors that happened this year. For all of you, now we're on YouTube, watching on YouTube. I appreciate you tuning in. Those of you listening to the Boone podcast today, until next time, we'll be right here.